It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
In the past week, the country has been rocked by the deaths of two black men at the hands of police. The first outside a store in Louisiana where Alton Sperling was shot multiple times by police officers, and in Minnesota where Philando Castile was shot during a traffic stop.
And many of us woke up this morning to the news that last night, during a peaceful protest in Dallas, shots rang out near the end of the demonstration. This time, it was sniper-style fire from a man who was targeting the police. So far, five officers have died in the shooting and seven others were injured.
In a week of tremendous violence and an outpouring of anger and sadness nationwide, where can we go from here? And how can we bridge the divide between law enforcement and communities of color?
Joining us now to talk about the shooting last night in Dallas is Jim Palmer. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
What was your reaction when you heard the news out of Dallas?
Well, I think like a lot of people, my reaction was one of anger and disgust and sadness. And, as I've had a little bit of time to be removed from initially learning about it, I think my most predominant fear is one of anxiety and concerned. I'm concerned that this event will lead to a greater polarization of people on all sides of the issues related to policing in America.
And what are you hearing from the members of your professional organization?
Well, predominantly from what I've heard and seen from officers in Wisconsin and frankly around the country through social media is predominantly anger at this point and frustration. And we just put out a press release or are in the process of putting out a statement to try and call for a sense of calm from everybody on this issue. And you know, oftentimes when these controversial incidents occur, whether it involves something that a police officer has done or the contrary or the reverse, like what we saw last night, it's far too common for people to engage in finger-pointing and hyperbolic attacks, and there's just nothing to be gained from that. And we need to really find a way as a society to break that cycle, and if we're ever going to resolve these issues.
This morning on NPR, the Dallas correspondent Wade Goodwin was talking about how the Dallas police force has really, in many ways, been doing things right and has really been making a lot of efforts. What do you know about the Dallas police force?
Well, as I understand it, it is one of the most diverse departments in the country. They have been actively engaged in implementing the recommendations of President Obama's task force on 21st century policing to their credit. And they have been affected by changes that the administration has made to a federal program that reduces their law enforcement's ability to benefit from federal military surplus equipment and things of that nature. So it is, from what I understand, an outstanding department that is representative of the community that it serves. And this is especially tragic in light of that.
Here's some audio of Dallas Police Chief David Brown addressing the media about the shooting this morning.
We're hurting. Our profession is hurting. Dallas officers are hurting. We are heartbroken. There are no words to describe the atrocity that occurred to our city. All I know is that this must stop, this divisiveness between our police and our citizens.
This must stop, this divisiveness between our police and our citizens. That is Dallas Police Chief David Brown addressing the media this morning. And Jim Palmer, you can hear the emotion in his voice. How does that divisiveness get addressed in the light of the events of this week?
Well, I think, as I said, I think we really, as a people, regardless of how you feel about these issues, need to encourage a sense of calm, and we need to take a breath, and we need to find a different way to address these issues. And I do think the media does play a significant role in that. I think it's easy for the media to draw attention to sensational and extreme views And I think, you know, those are counterproductive to the kind of informed dialogue that we need in this country.
And of course, there are the on-the-street police officers, other law enforcement officials, but then there is also top law enforcement, whether at a state level, a national level. What role do you see for kind of those leaders in law enforcement to be able to take to help bridge these gaps and these different perceptions?
Well, that's a great question, and it's quite frankly a role that I haven't seen many of them fulfill as of yet. What I have seen is, you know, groups rush to point the finger and assign blame, and I don't think, you know, I think the issues surrounding policing in America and institutional racism are far too complex to blame on any one person or any one organization or a profession. And we really do need, you know, our leaders at the national level, at the state level, at the local level to you know, extend a hand, because where we're relegated to now is a closed fist. And this is is going to continue to be a growing concern. And we really are at a critical point, and I think, in our history. And if we don't break the cycle of how we've responded to things, how we've approached things, and how these things are covered, I think we're in serious trouble.
Interestingly, Trevor Noah of The Daily Show, the night before the shooting in Dallas, so keep in mind when we hear this audio that this was actually before the events in Dallas, but talking after the shootings by police of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, he said this.
If you're pro-Black Lives Matter, you're assumed to be anti-police. And if you're pro-police, then you surely hate black people. It seems that it's either pro-cop and anti-black or pro-black and anti-cop, when in reality, you can be pro-cop and pro-black, which is what we should all be. It is what we should be aiming for.
So aiming to be pro-black, pro-cop.
I absolutely agree. And I think it is okay to recognize the service and sacrifice of the dedicated men and women of our law enforcement community and still have questions and concerns about how officers conduct themselves. And law enforcement, I think, is generally receptive to those concerns. The law enforcement profession is always looking to grow and to learn from past prior incidents. And I think it's tremendously important that we somehow, again, find a way to break the cycle and broaden the dialogue, and that we talk not only about how law enforcement officers conduct themselves, but how also pay some attention to, you know, how the public interacts with law enforcement officers. And, you know, there are things that we can do, initial steps that we can take that we frankly just aren't taking.
We're talking with Jim Palmer right now. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. And we're talking at the end of this very violent week about what we as a nation can do to mend some of those divisions between law enforcement and communities. Now, the shooter who was killed last night or early this morning in Dallas, who had shot the officers who were both killed and are in the hospital right now, was actually had served in the U.S. Army Reserve. And obviously, it's too soon to try to guess suspects' motives. But what is the relationship usually between law enforcement officials and the military? It would seem to me like they're somewhat akin to each other.
You know, I think there is a great kinship. At the same time, just with the recent tragic shooting in Orlando, we saw someone who had tried to get law enforcement jobs and worked as a security guard. So I don't know that while there is generally a kinship, obviously it's not universal.
And how different is it for police to try to deal with a situation like this where someone has a military background? It seems like that would up the ante in a lot of ways.
Well, it would. And it does sound from the initial reports that this ambush last night was very well coordinated. And it may have involved multiple shooters. I'm not sure that that's been confirmed. But even if it was just one perpetrator, it does sound like he had some had more than a basic knowledge, working knowledge of firearms and other tactical dynamics that he used to his advantage and to the disadvantage of not only the officers that were working to protect the right of protesters to protest them, but also to civilians. I think it's important to include them as well.
President Obama spoke out about the incident today from Poland, where he is there for a NATO summit. Here's what the president had to say.
Even as yesterday I spoke about our need to be concerned as all Americans about racial disparities in our criminal justice system, I also said yesterday that our police have an extraordinarily difficult job, and the vast majority of them do their job in outstanding fashion. I also indicated the degree to which we need to be supportive of those officers who do their job each and every day, protecting us and protecting our communities. Today is a wrenching reminder of the sacrifices that they make for us. We also know that when people are armed with powerful weapons, unfortunately, it makes attacks like these more deadly and more tragic. And in the days ahead, we're going to have to consider those realities as well.
President Obama there speaking from Poland, taking somewhat of a middle stance there, speaking both on behalf of the police and for communities of color. The incidents that preceded the shooting in Dallas, the killing of Alton Sterling in Louisiana, the killing of Philando Castile in Minnesota, weren't isolated incidents. Similar shootings of men of color have happened and have happened with an alarming regularity. As someone who works with law enforcement and represents law enforcement, what's the message that needs to get to those officers on the street and to the communities that they're serving?
Well, I think both with surrounding all these issues, I think there has to be a greater sense of calm. Again, not to be redundant, but when these controversial incidents arise and partial or incomplete videos come to light, I think we need to, as a people generally, be more mindful of the fact that an investigation has to occur, and that no one should rush to judgment. And I think that would be far more prudent than how many of these controversial incidents have been addressed by some in the past. And I think that, again, that includes the media, not to beat up on the media by any means. I think, those sensational views and, a lot of discussion and dialogue and rhetoric surrounds these viral videos that may or may not actually purport what occurred. That's why we have investigations. Wisconsin's fortunate in the sense that we do have a law that mandates the independent investigations of officer-involved shootings, and we're one of only three states that currently does that.
And so there are 47 states, then, that don't. And so I think that what you would hear from many of the communities who feel that they are not being served as well by police is that if we don't get this out there, if this video isn't released, if it doesn't go viral, there's not going to be justice.
Well, I understand that. I think that there are three things off the top of my head that I think we have to seriously, as a national community, actively and aggressively pursue. And one is mandating independent investigations of officer-involved shootings on a broad scale. Secondly, I do believe that body cameras need to be implemented across the country. That doesn't mean that I or the WPPA believes that body cameras are a panacea or that going to cure all of the ills surrounding these issues, but they would provide us with more information than we currently have. And thirdly, we need better data. Better data needs to be collected and analyzed and examined by the public and by the government, so that we can really quantify the perceptions that exist around the country about police conduct. That's not something that we're doing. And frankly, until we do those things, until we equip ourselves with more information, I just don't see us being able to move beyond where we are in terms of this totally destructive discourse in this country.
Jim Palmer stays with us now. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, the largest law enforcement group in the state. We're discussing the shooting at a protest in Dallas last night that resulted in the deaths of five police officers. And that protest was a demonstration against recent police shootings of black men in Louisiana and Minnesota.
And we want to hear from you. What would you like to see change in the country? What conversations have you had with your friends or your family about the events this week? And is there a way forward to stop the violence. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can join the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the violence of the past week. Jim Palmer is with us. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. It's the largest law enforcement organization in the state.
And we want to hear from you. What was your reaction to the news about the shooting in Dallas last night? What would you like to see change in the relationship between law enforcement and communities of color? And where do we go from here? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave your comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email your thoughts to talk@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones, and Jeff in Oshkosh is up first. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
And thank you all for talking about what has always been a really important issue. And it seems for the first time that I can ever remember, there's suddenly concern for civil rights and for the protection of citizens who often do get minor or major mistreatment at the hands of police. And I'm glad for your guest. He certainly is a professional, and it's good to hear his points of view on these matters. I was wondering if you might have any ideas about accountability coming down from the elected officials, from the investigators, from the Department of Justice. I was just, you know, I've only seen a few of those Making a Murderer documentaries, but the first one was very striking when there was investigations by the Attorney General's office that concluded that, yes, there was a frame-up and it was wrong, but Attorney General Lautenschlager said that there was nothing intentional, when obviously there was intentional stuff.
And thanks for that call, Jeff. I want to give Jim Palmer a chance to respond. So the issue of accountability, there can be investigations, but do they lead to accountability?
Well, they should. I can tell you and your listeners with all confidence that nobody wants a bad officer out of the profession and held accountable than a good officer. And I think that's something that's lost on a lot of people, and that many people unfortunately jump to the conclusion that you know, there's this thin blue line that separates law enforcement officers from the rest of the community and the communities they serve. And I simply don't believe that. Law enforcement officers have made the conscious decision to pursue a calling that puts at risk their personal safety so they can protect the safety and security of others. I frankly don't believe there's any higher calling. And I think, you know, much of the media attention and the discourse around these issues overlooks that, I think takes it for granted.
I think there is sometimes a perception that police will close ranks around their brothers and sisters in blue, and that even those bad cops will be protected. What would you say to that?
You know, there may have been a time in our history where that was true. I can tell you that from the men and women in Wisconsin with whom I interact on a daily basis, I don't believe that is true. And they recognize that an officer who dishonors the badge in the line of duty dishonors their profession and everyone else who wears the badge, and not only them, but also their families. And we sometimes, many times, overlook the families of law enforcement officers, and they really are a critically important part of our law enforcement community. You know, even though they may not wear a badge and strap on a gun, they make an officer's service to the community possible, and it's important to recognize that.
Let's go back to the phones, and Stephen in Milwaukee is up. Hello, Stephen.
Hi there. I just want to say I understand what. First of all, I want to say that it truly is a tragedy what happened, and a shame. These officers that were killed and injured, they do put their lives on the line for us, and they do a tough job, and I am personally appreciative of what they do. That being said, part of the problem is that the police themselves cause this, because as just stated, there are a few bad apples. Not very few police officers really shouldn't be on the force. However, when they do something to injure a citizen, the thin blue line comes up and they're literally protected. Perfect example was a few years ago here in Milwaukee. Two black men were almost beaten to death by Milwaukee police officers, off duty police officers, because they were invited to a party by two white women. Police literally either lied on the stand or absolutely refused to cooperate with district attorney, so no charges could be dropped. How can you possibly expect anyone to have confidence in a police that if someone does something wrong, that they'll be prosecuted and taken care of? That's not the reality.
And I want to give Jim Palmer a chance to respond to that, Stephen.
Well, I think, Stephen acknowledged in his prefatory remarks that law enforcement officers do a tough job and that the vast majority of them do their job honorably. I think that's the thing that we need to avoid losing sight of when an incident, a controversial incident, arises. I remember my parents used to say when I was very young that, you don't get we're not going to thank you for making your bed. You're supposed to do that. Law enforcement officers aren't going to, be recognized for doing their job the way that they should. I would argue that perhaps they should be. But we have made in Wisconsin significant gains and continue to make significant efforts to find ways to improve not only the relationship between law enforcement officers and the communities they serve, but how law enforcement officers are held accountable and how they do their jobs, and so that it meets with, to some extent, to a large extent, the community standards under which they have to operate.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. It's the largest law enforcement group in the state. He joined us to talk about the targeted shootings that happened last night at a protest in Dallas. So far, there have been multiple officers killed and injured in last night's shooting, as well as civilians. We invite you to continue this discussion on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you see as the next steps for bringing our country together, and how can we build over those divides between law enforcement and communities of color?
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Friday, and this week we're talking about vegetarian cooking with recipes from around the world. We'll take familiar meat recipes and talk about how to make them vegetarian friendly, and we'll introduce you to recipes from all across the globe.
Marie Simmons is with us now. She's the author of more than a dozen cookbooks, as well as being a cooking teacher and winner of a Julia Child Award and two James Beard Awards. Her most recent cookbook is called Whole World Vegetarian, and it's out right now. Marie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, Marie, as I understand, you're not a vegetarian yourself, so why write a vegetarian cookbook?
Well, I think I wrote a vegetarian cookbook because I realized that although I am not a bona fide vegetarian, we eat lots of vegetarian meals. And I don't think vegetarian is necessarily separate from that. I mean, I love vegetables, always have. Growing up as children, my mother was a very good Italian cook, and we ate all kinds of vegetables all the time, sometimes two vegetables with every meal. So it seemed perfectly natural for me, and this is actually my second vegetarian book. I did another one a couple of years ago called Fresh and Fast Vegetarian. So, I'm not a newcomer to the concept of vegetarian.
Let's spend a little more time on those family recipes. You said that, there were often multiple vegetables in a meal, but what were some of the typical menus of those family meals?
Well, there would always be, for my father, who was quite the carnivore, we always had at least, some roast chicken or some a stew. But definitely one of the vegetables we had constantly was broccoli rabe, which now is sold in many, many supermarkets. It's actually grown in California, but it's an Italian vegetable in the sense that you see it a lot in the markets in Italy. If you go to the farm stands, farmers markets in the different town squares, they always have it. And my mother would always say, some of us we would there were three children, one or two of us would complain, well, it's bitter, Mom, and she would say, eat it. It's filled with iron. It's good for you. So anyway, she always had those little, you know, trying to entice us to eat, you know, eat your carrots, they're good for your eyes, you know, those kinds of things. But anyway, this is long before she knew about the nutrition that was involved. But that we had that often. We always had artichokes in season, which is something that comes to mind because my friends, you know, if I brought them home from school after school and they had dinner with us, they would always, you know, be very surprised at the look of the artichoke. They'd never had it, and it was just so common for us. And we always had a big green salad with every meal. And I remember the dressing was very tangy with vinegar. And after we took the leaves, and my father would always dip his crust of bread in the little bit of dressing left in the bottom of the bowl. And so I remember those things very clearly. Now, all these years later, my parents have been deceased for quite a while. I remember all those little details when I'm sitting and writing, and which is kind of fun for me. And I've learned that people enjoy those anecdotal stories about food and recipes because they have their own. You know, if we think about it, each and every one of us has something to remember about family meals.
And I know you write that at some point you realize that some of the most exciting cooking going on in the world, you know, you have the what you eat at home with your family, but there's also what's going on and globally that some of the most exciting food there was vegetarian food.
Well, it was, and it wasn't until I started thinking more seriously about vegetarian dishes that I came to that conclusion. I've had the good fortune to do quite a bit of traveling not recently, but in the past. And I always remembered certain dishes, and I would write them down and try to recreate them at home. And then it occurred to me that, my goodness, you know, these are vegetarian. You can certainly put together a very good meal with all vegetable dishes, and I've done it often. In fact, the Fresh and Fast vegetarian is called Recipes That Make a Meal. And it was through my teaching that I came to the conclusion that people were interested in vegetarian cooking, interested in health, you know, trying to eat less of certain meats. But they didn't necessarily know how to put a meal together so that it would be satisfying. And that's one of the things we run into sometimes if it's the cook in the family is trying to entice the other members in the family to sit down to a table with, you know, just vegetables. And I think with flavorings and spices and going to the international pantry, which is what I sometimes refer to my spice drawers as, you know, I have smoked paprika, which I was introduced to through Spanish cooking. And I have garam masala, which, you know, of course, is prominent in throughout India, and various other spices that really add a lot of flavor and a lot of excitement to every taste. And so you feel satisfied. You don't miss that hamburger or sausage link or hot dog or whatever else, you know, might have been served at the same time.
We're talking with Marie Simmons. She's the author of Whole World Vegetarian. And Marie, I also grew up with an Italian-American mother, and you talking about the artichoke hearts definitely resonated with me. And one of the recipes that you have in the book and that we have posted on the Central Time Facebook page is chickpeas and pasta with artichoke hearts. And I have to say, when I think of those vegetables that I grew up with, artichokes and chickpeas are right up there on the top of the list. Tell us about that recipe.
Well, that was inspired, and I do different versions of it all the time, and I really wanted to include one in Whole World Vegetarian with chichi impasto, which was basically a, you know, chickpea and elbow macaroni in a very soupy broth that we would have on Friday nights because Fridays being brought up in an Italian Catholic family, we didn't have meat on Friday nights. Mm-hmm. So we would have that. And I love that dish. and, you know, we'd sprinkled lots of Parmesan cheese on it, and it was very hearty and very satisfying. And so that inspired, and then I just, you know, decided, well, what else can I do with this? You know, sometimes I would put green beans in it, any, you know, something, other flavor, another texture, and I decided to use the artichoke hearts. And it was very successful. We really liked it. So that's how it made it into the book, but it definitely was inspired by my mother's cooking.
And you've got, from somewhere else along the globe there, you've got an Indian-inspired recipe, butternut squash korma. Can you tell us about that one?
Yes. Well, that was a stretch. Some of these, I don't necessarily claim these to be 100% authentic, but I actually just use the concept of the korma, which is, you know, usually with chicken. But, it, you know, they can use other things as well. And the sauce is made with nuts. And let's see, I want to look at the recipe so I can talk to you intelligently about it. I absolutely love Indian food and all those flavors. So, and this korma has just such a rich flavor. I think it has coconut milk and I'm going to look it up in right now so I can talk to you about it. I should have marked it. But it's really a very satisfying dish. I was so excited the first time I made it because I really wasn't quite sure how I was going to adapt this. And I have a tendency when I'm developing recipes of thinking a lot about them before I get in the kitchen and the ingredients and try to put it together in my head. And so that really, I mean, that comes only because I'm such an experienced cook. I've been doing recipe development. Well, my first job at a college was in the 1960s, late 60s. So, you know, I've been at this a long time and I'm still cooking up a storm.
And you said this one was a stretch. Was that because of the butternut squash? I'm wondering if there are others in the book where you feel like, well, this was usually made with meat, but I think I got by making it vegetarian.
Oh, yeah. The moussaka was definitely one that the Greek, traditional Greek, although it might, maybe I didn't use, maybe it was the pasticcio, but the korma is...
It's page 224.
I found it, yes. And I remember the picture is so... attractive. I hope there's a picture.
Yes, it looks delicious.
Yeah, it does. And I really, that was very rich. I remember eating it many, many times at restaurants. It was very rich. And so I did use the cashews and I pureed them with, you know, the spices and the curry powder. And then I finished it with yogurt, not with coconut milk, with yogurt. And it was just so rich and so delicious. I think it's just the cashews. You know, vegan cooking uses cashews a lot to thicken sauces and things. And they really are a good thing to keep on hand, raw, unsalted cashews. I suggest keeping them in the freezer so they don't spoil if you don't use them often. And the other thing I keep on hand is always a knob of fresh ginger.
Mm-hmm.
I use it up so quickly that it really doesn't have a chance to dry up or spoil. And I've learned that it's better just leave it plain in your vegetable bin. Don't put it in plastic or wrap it in any way. Just put it in the way it is in the grocery store, you know, without any wrapping, and it'll stay fresh for a couple of weeks at least.
We're talking with Marie Simmons about her most recent cookbook right now. It's called Whole World Vegetarian. And by the way, the recipe for that korma that she was just describing, along with a picture, a delicious-looking picture, posted right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we want to hear from you. Tell us about some of your favorite vegetarian recipes. Have you made a meat-free version of a classic meat dish? Tell us how you put your own twist on it by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe you have a favorite meat dish that you want to make more vegetarian friendly. Marie is happy to give you tips on how to do that. Call 800-642-1234.
Right now it's Food Friday, and we're joined by Marie Simmons. She's the author of the cookbook Whole World Vegetarian.
And we're hoping that you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite vegetarian recipe from around the world? What ingredients do you turn to instead of meat in your cooking? Maybe share some shopping tips for buying vegetarian-friendly ingredients. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, we've also posted some of Marie's recipes that you can try out. Maybe you have a popular meat dish that you want to make without meat and need help from Marie. You can get that help by calling 800-642-1234. Now, Marie, you've been cooking for a long time, it sounds like. How much of a change have you seen in American supermarkets that make it easier to make some of these recipes?
Oh, I've seen an enormous change. I was a food editor at Cuisine Magazine many years ago and in the 1980s, and I can remember getting angry letters from readers who did not know what arugula was or did not recognize, you know, Parmigiano Reggiano. And so if you go, I was just in the supermarket this morning, and I mean, I'm just amazed. First of all, they had a huge display of tortillas from all these different bakeries. Some of them were corn, some of them were flour, some of them were obviously artisanal, some of them were commercially prepared. You never would have seen that even 20 years ago unless you went into a market in a Latin neighborhood. So it's you see now whole areas of, first of all, a lot of organic produce, and boxed crackers and all kinds of things in your everyday store. I know our local Fred Meyer has a whole section of organics. And they also have an international aisle, and you can get Asian ingredients. You can get Indian ingredients. You can get even Moroccan. You can get Ras El Hanout. They don't call it that, but they call it a Moroccan spice blend. So you can, you know, if you look, you can buy smoked paprika, which is used a lot in Spain. The original comes from Spain. So it's just amazing to me. I guess this is a long-winded answer to your question, which is basically yes, I've seen huge changes.
I want to talk about another one of those sort of family and friends-based recipes that you love. This is a recipe for Evans Jamaican rice and beans. So tell us about what goes into that one.
Well, that was a really fun one because I had never made something like that before. And the recipe was given to me by a good friend of mine whose husband grew up in Jamaica. And this was a family recipe, something they enjoyed there. And it's made with rice, and I make it with peas, dried peas, and you can also make it with you could use any kind of pea, actually dried pea, and it's one of my favorite recipes. It takes you have to follow the directions fairly carefully because it has unusual steps in it, I think. Let me read you the procedure. 239 is where it is. I want to make sure I get it all right for you. And I don't think there is a picture of that
one. No picture for this one.
Unfortunately, I guess it wasn't that photogenic. But anyway, so it was... The peas for this dish are usually small, round, dried peas. And so they can come in very different colors, from ivory to pale green, whatever you can find. You won't go, or even dark red. I think I actually made this with very small red kidney beans. Mm-hmm. You can find those. And so Pam and Desmond Elder, who are my friends, were the ones who told me about this recipe. It's made with coconut milk and dried thyme and a little bit of curry powder. And Evan was the one who perfected the family recipes. So sometimes if you live in the South, you can, or maybe even in the Midwest, you can find pigeon peas, mm-hmm. what are called pigeon peas. But anyway, it doesn't have that many ingredients, but it has 5 different steps to it, and it can be made in different. You cook the beans for 1.5 to 2.5 hours, and you save the water from that. And you use that plus the coconut milk to cook the rice, and then you add the spices. And also, you can use a spicy chili pepper or habanero, which is very, very spicy, mm-hmm. In this dish as well. And then you cook it in with the rice. Then you actually remove it in the seeds and the stem, and you just put some of the mashed up flesh back in the dish. It is really a simple dish. You could make it ahead. And reheat it. And in fact, I think I add a little note from Evan who said that it's even better the next day.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned using that broth from the beans to cook the rice, because often some of the things that you run into in trying to demeatify a recipe is things like the broth. So what are some of your favorite meat replacements and recipes that might call for meat or meat products?
Well, in terms of broth, I've tried the different boxed vegetable broths from the supermarket. Some of them, they all have a slightly different flavor profile. Some of them have a little more carrot. Some of them have a little more onion. And so it changes a little bit with each brand. And so what I suggest for people to do is, buy maybe 2 different kinds and taste them separately and see what you think, what you like. I also, it's very easy to make vegetable broth, and I have, I think, 2 different recipes. One with roasted vegetables, which is my favorite because it's the most flavorful. You get all that sort of caramelized flavor from, the onion and the red pepper and those ingredients. And so that's one recipe, and I'll make that up, and it might make 8 cups, and then I'll freeze it in 2 cups. Freezer containers, and I use that as a basis for a lot of my soups. But if you start with a lot of, for when you're making soups, I just made one yesterday. You start with a lot of vegetables, sautéed, and you add water to it. That'll make a good vegetable broth. You have maybe a cup and a half or 2 cups of onion, this similar amount of celery, carrot, garlic. And you just saute it in a little bit of oil and then add 1 quart of water and simmer that. Sometimes I add a little tomato paste, which gives it a nice little acid hit and depth of flavor. Or I might add a can of diced tomatoes to, give it that much more flavor. But in terms of other ingredients, is that what you were asking
as
well as meat substitutes? I find sauteed onions, so that they're not burned, but they're golden brown. Take your time to do it, 10 to 15 minutes, and a little bit of olive oil, which is what I use exclusively in this book, and in most of my cooking as well. That golden onion will give it nice depth of flavor. And as long as you have big flavors, you don't need the meat necessarily. Mushrooms are another major addition, and there's so many mushrooms. You can buy, even in my regular supermarket, you can buy shiitake, you can buy pleurotes, all different, they call them exotic. Sometimes there's a mix of what they call exotics. And, those, just saute those and add them to a dish, pasta, or I use them in the dish, I mentioned the Greek dish before. The one I ended up putting in here was the pastizio.
Pastizio. That sounds terrific, Marie. We have to leave it there. We're out of time, but that was Marie Simmons. She's the author of more than 12 cookbooks with inspiration there for vegetarian cooking. Her new cookbook is called Whole World Vegetarian. Don't forget, you can find a bunch of those recipes and pictures on the Central Time Facebook page.
The 2016 Olympic Games will launch in Rio de Janeiro in just a few short weeks. And as is common, there is a flurry of activity to get everything ready for the influx of fans and athletes. But much closer to home, Rio, Wisconsin is preparing for their own summer games.
Although it's spelled the same as Rio in Brazil, it's pronounced differently because of a typographical error, it turns out. The name of the village was supposed to be Ohio, but the 1860s paperwork was handwritten, and the O and the H were read as an R, thus Rio, rhyming with Ohio.
While the Brazilian games are dealing with doping scandals, security concerns, and the threat of Zika infection, Rio has its own concerns.
It's going to be a lot of gridlock, so to speak, in this town. We haven't had, we don't have even a traffic light in this town, so it'd be a little different, different world for us, but we'll make it work.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun in Rio. What kind of events do you think they would have?
I'm guessing classic Wisconsin things, maybe hay bales. Mm-hmm. Are there cow chips involved, Judith? I don't know.
Not that I'm aware of, but perhaps they thought that would scare off some of the, I'm sure, international competitors that are going to be coming.
But I guess if you want to keep it simple, you want to save on an airline ticket, and you don't have to worry about stop signs or crowds, go to Rio.
Rio's the place to go. Well, we're sending our best wishes to the athletes competing in Rio and Rio this summer, and let the games begin.